48. Our uphill journey isn't quite as fast-paced as the sprint across the killing field, but the horses are working just as hard, if not harder. They're huffing and frothing, desperate for a break and for a drink they're not going to get. At least not until we reach the peak, and maybe not even then. We attack a dull slope at an angle, following a switchback pattern. It's slower than charging straight up, but the grade would be too steep for the horses in some areas. We're making the best time possible. We'll reach the peak in about 20 minutes, far faster than we could manage on foot, even in the tunnels. Even the golf carts with their small electric motors wouldn't be able to tear up the mountainside at our current pace, and I suspect they'd run out of juice long before these tough horses. When we cross the threshold between the encroaching night and the last rays of light still reaching Adele's side, the sun provides me with a bit of hope. It's filtered by the thick canopy, but the jungle is brighter, easier to navigate, and harder to hide in. I'm not sure if Tul Kalu could overtake us and stage an ambush. He might not be fast or quiet enough to pull it off. And as much as he might want to track us down and kill us, for reasons unknown to me, my gut says he won't be able to resist joining the fray behind us, at least for a bit. When, if, he finds us, I have no doubt he'll be bathed in prehistoric blood. When the Cherokee dubbed him the God of the Hunt, they were being generous, or perhaps they just didn't have words for psychopath and serial killer. Then again, perhaps Tul Kalu gave himself the title, installing himself as a deity among men. Hell, actual men have done that since the dawn of civilization, all the way up to the modern world, and people still fall for it. When a buzzing sound fills the air, my body tenses. If a flux wave as big as the last hits us now, we'll be launched off the mountainside. But I sense no onrushing wall of temporal power. Instead, the buzz grows subtly louder until I identify where it's coming from. Above. A drone. My horse flinches at the flying machine's arrival, but pushes past its fear when I give it a nudge. The drone keeps pace with me, 20 feet above.
"Can't say I'm a fan of what you're attempting," Langdon says from the drone.
"Just trying to stay alive," I reply. He chuckles.
"Oh, you're doing more than that. You don't think I'm aware of what is following you to my doorstep?"
"Going to bring him a lot further than your doorstep," I think, but I say nothing. "You know what it is," Cassie says, "don't you?"
"Miss Dearborn, we discovered his identity together. The Nephilim were..."
"You knew from the start," she says. "That's why you're trying so hard to keep it away. You know what it's capable of. You know how hard it is to kill."
"If it can be killed," Langdon says after a beat. "You're right, of course. I'm an intelligent man. I did my research. I knew the risks associated with time travel, including who and what we might encounter along the way. We know it died, but not how. The skeletons uncovered by the Smithsonian showed no signs of advanced aging or catastrophic injury. But they were all missing their heads. Some were missing limbs as well."
Langdon's words remind me of how Tul Kalu took every bullet fired at him, unless they were aimed at his head. And now he's wearing the saber-toothed skull for protection. That's got to be the key. But will a bullet do the job, or do we actually need to sever his head?
"They?" Levi says. "How many skeletons are there?"
"Dozens," Langdon says. "They've never been as prevalent as mankind, not remotely. That they are still not among us suggests the others migrated somewhere else, someplace remote, unbothered by mankind." "You think people chased the Nephilim off?" Cassie asks. "That the Indians somehow killed Tul Kalu?" Another chuckle. He's enjoying this, relaxed. Whatever he's here for, he's close to achieving it. The drone's presence suggests that we and Tul Kalu are still a threat, but he's feeling confident.
"It's more likely that another of his kind did the deed, or something else, equally nefarious, with a penchant for body parts."
"What do you want?" Enola asks, cutting to the chase. I'm impressed with how well she's adapted to her new reality, full of monsters and technology, both of which must be strange to someone who has no concept of machinery, electricity, or theoretical physics. Then again, Tul Kalu is straight out of her life experience, and who knows what other ancient North American knowledge has been passed down by her people. Langdon goes silent, leaving me to ponder Enola's question. What does he want? Why is he talking to us now?
"He's distracting us," Flora says, eyes turned downhill. I scan the forest below but see nothing more than trees. There are modern birds and squirrels here, but so far the dinosaurs have avoided this elevated land, probably because the air is thinner and their big bodies need all the oxygen they can get.
I don't see anything,
Owen says, twisting around my father to have a look for himself. Doesn't mean he's not there, my father says. If he's really a hunter, we won't know he's there until he fires the first shot. But Langdon will. You know where he is, I say to the drone. You're watching him right now, aren't you?
I'm going to give you a chance to turn back,
Langdon says, confirming my suspicion by not addressing it. Ride east and then back down. The land there is clear of danger. Except for the giant still hunting us. Or return to the tunnels where you will be... His voice trails off. I'm afraid your time is running out. Is he talking about Sul Kalu or another flux? I'm about to ask when a bullet rips through the air and the drone. The flying machine falls silent and drops from the sky, narrowly missing my head.
Sorry, Levi says, holstering his weapon. Man's a snake oil salesman. The more we listen to him, the more danger we're in.
Can't say I disagree with him, but it would have been nice to get an answer to my lingering question. Langdon isn't afraid to let us die for his cause, but he's not exactly out to kill us either. Not yet. I suspect his indifference to our fate will shift if we continue to threaten him. He wasn't just suggesting we lead the giant away. He was threatening to take action if we refused. I want to offer the others one last chance to back out, but we're well beyond the point of no return. Anyone who takes a different route risks being found by the hunter without the full force of our ragtag unit. Going back means fighting Sul Kalu head-on, and I'm not confident any of us would survive that. Pushing forward is our only real hope of survival. Langdon has an army of drones, but I know how to fight and destroy tech better than I do demigods. The drones are also guided by an AI whose tactics can be predicted, or by people whose skills on the battlefield are outmatched by me and Flores. The odds aren't great, but they're the best we've got. I push my horse harder and continue upward at a steeper angle. The horse whinnies in protest, but it pounds up the hill. If Langdon chose to confront us now, it means we're close. And so is the giant. It also means there's still time to stop him. I have my doubts about Black Creek's survival in the Cretaceous, having seen the scope of what our small pocket of now homeless humanity is up against. But I doubt things will get easier 100 million years further back in time. And before that, before the first single-celled organisms split and evolved into things with eyes and limbs and brains, I don't think we could even breathe the air. I yank back on the reins when the sound of tank treads reaches my ears. The mini-tanks are waiting for us. The moment we emerge from the tree line, we'll have declared war on Langdon and we'll be cut down.
We can't go up there,
Cassie says, pointing out what I already know.
And we can't stay here,
Levi adds. Thank you for making that clear to me, I say, laying on the sarcasm.
So we'll do both, my father says.
I'm about to point out the many reasons splitting up is a bad idea when he continues.
Look around, ignore the new growth. We're near the peak, near the tree line created by the mine. That hasn't changed. Focus on the topography. You know where we are.
I scan the area, trying to see what he has already, but I'm either too tired or too distracted to spot anything familiar in the failing light. The sun's rays have raced ahead of us, now bathing the barren peak in its orange glow. Soon it will be gone altogether and the night will fall. I've never been afraid of the dark, but I'm pretty sure that will change in about, an hour.
Ugh.
Owen shakes his head at me and points into the forest to my right.
The tunnel thing is over there.
My father confirms his assessment by adding, maybe we can find a way in. Next time, just spit it out, I say. I'm too old for lessons.
Cause you failed them.
Owen smiles at his verbal jab. Wise ass, I say to him.
Shit for brains,
he replies. Levi thrusts his hand in the air like a student in class.
I'm just going to point out that we've got hot metal death waiting for us up there and primal rage carnage racing up behind us. If y'all are done being samesies, I reckon now might be a good time to pick which kind of horrible demise we prefer, because in a minute, we ain't going to have a choice.
Unless we keep on moving up this mountainside, Flora says. That demigod asshole won't have a trail to follow. And there's the problem. Diverting our course risks delaying or preventing Sul Kalu's introduction to Langdon and his killing machines. A howl rolls up the mountainside. We're out of time. Too much talking, Enola says, hopping down from her horse. Not enough doing. Then she seals her fate and maybe ours by slapping her horse's rump and sending it sprinting uphill.